In this case, we're not referring to the entire population of wolves. We're referring to wolves in this one specific area.
A petition to the Board of Game to prevent hunting of Denali wolves. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Talkeetna residents work to clean up after flooding brings unpleasant waters into their homes.
We still, when we left today, have 8 inches of sewer water in our basement.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
A group of wildlife conservation organizations filed a petition for reconsideration today with the Alaska Board of Game that requests the adoption of an emergency regulation to prohibit trapping and hunting of wolves along the eastern border of Denali National Park and Preserve. Tina Brown is the president of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance.
The board made errors in its interpretation of the criteria.
The original petition filed last month asked the board to reestablish an emergency no-hunting zone to protect wolves in the Grant Creek Pack. Biologists believe that pack abandoned its historic den site and dispersed this summer after a local trapper took one breeding female, a second died, and no wolf pups survived this year. The board did not have any biological concerns and rejected the petition. Brown says there are errors in the board's interpretation of criteria required for the adoption of an emergency no-hunting zone.
Emergency doesn't only apply in biological emergency in an entire population. And in this case, we're not referring to the entire population of wolves. We're referring to wolves in this one specific area.
In 2010, the Board of Game canceled two buffer zones that protected wolves outside of the park because they considered the wolf population to be healthy. The board has placed a moratorium on any consideration of the issue until 2016. The National Park Service is counting wolves that live in and around Denali National Park this month to get a better idea of how the population has changed. Alaskans decided on mayors, assembly members, and school board candidates in local elections across the state yesterday. Fairbanks North Star Borough incumbent Luke Hopkins won a second 3-year term with more than 51% of the vote over challenger Norm Phillips. Voters in the Fairbanks North Star Borough also approved an initiative that bans borough officials from regulating air pollution from wood from home heating devices, including hydronic heaters that burn wood. The decision strips the borough of enforcement powers connected to air quality and wood-burning devices. The decision comes a few months before state and local officials must submit a plan telling the Environmental Protection Agency how the area will correct its perennially polluted air. In other races, we have updates from the Mat-Su Borough, Wrangell, Sitka, and we'll start in Juneau.
The capital city is getting a new mayor, while a bond proposition for local projects appears to be failing. I'm Matt Miller in Juneau, where in the mayor's race, former firefighter and former assembly member Merrill Sanford maintains an edge over Cheryl Geeby, the former head of the local chapter of the League of Women Voters. Sanford campaigned on fostering a pro-economic business climate.
We want people to come here, and we want people to open stores here, no matter what the store is. And we want jobs here.
GB jumped into the race almost at the last minute and said she wanted to bring new energy to Juneau.
It took me a while to get going, yes. If I had another month, I think the numbers would be different. I would have had more time to talk to individual people.
Sanford will likely replace Bruce Botello, who is just finishing 3 consecutive terms as mayor and could not run again this year because of term limits. Juneau voters also elected assembly members and members of the local school board. A measure extending a temporary 1% sales tax for 5 years to fund a variety of deferred maintenance and capital improvement projects passed, but a $25 million bond issue for another package of projects may be defeated by a narrow margin. If the bond issue does pass, then a portion of the revenues from the temporary sales tax would help fund the bond's debt service and mitigate some of the burden on property taxpayers. Unofficial voter turnout in Juneau was just over 25%, with over 1,400 absentee and question ballots still to be counted. Those returns could change the final results for the bond issue and the mayor's race. The final ballot count is Friday, with the results likely certified on Tuesday. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
This is Ariel Van Cleve in Wrangell. According to unofficial results from the Wrangell Borough Clerk, David Jack beat challenger Don McConaughey in the mayoral race by only 5 votes. James Stowe received 400 votes for Borough Assembly Seat C and will serve a 3-year term. Pam McCloskey also will serve a 3-year term on the Assembly. She received 426 votes and ran unopposed. Maxlin Wiederspoon won a seat on the Assembly Board by receiving almost 200 more votes than her challenger, Billy Younts. She will serve an unexpired term until October of next year. The Canvas Board will meet at City Hall Thursday afternoon to go through absentee ballots, and the Borough Assembly plans to certify official results next Monday evening. I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
This is Ed Ronco in Sitka, where incumbent Mayor Cheryl Westover has been unseated. Assemblymember Mim McConnell brought in more than 46% of the vote in a 3-way race for mayor. Westover had a third of the ballots cast, Assemblymember Tor Christensen roughly 20%. McConnell says she's ready to jump in.
Oh, I have so many ideas. I'm excited about the future, and I'm ready to go to work, and I'm looking for people to work with me.
There were 3 seats open on Sitka's Assembly. Voters returned Phyllis Hackett to a 3-year term. Also elected was Matthew Hunter, who said he is excited and humbled by the more than 1,700 votes he received Tuesday night.
That's a lot of people, and I don't know that I know that many people in Sitka. So this is really exciting, and I look forward to representing the people.
The 3rd seat goes to Michelle Putz, who will serve for 1 year. 4th place finisher Aaron Swanson is behind by 85 votes, pending the count of nearly 400 absentee ballots. Dallas Peavy took 5th place to round out a crowded field for Assembly. This is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
I'm Ellen Lockyer. Larry DeVilbiss garnered almost twice as many votes on Tuesday, as did challenger Mark Masteller, to retain his seat as Matanuska-Susitna Borough Mayor. Just over 15% of the registered voters in the borough turned out to the polls. Close to 2,000 absentee and special needs ballots are yet to be counted, and election results won't be official until October 16th. DeVilbiss was elected in a special election in January of 2011 to fill a partial term when a former borough mayor stepped down. If DeVilbiss is sworn in this time, it will mark his first full term. Borough mayors can serve 2 terms. Borough voters okayed a ballot proposition that would give seniors and disabled veterans a boost in their property tax exemptions, but voters turned down a bid to create a new fire service area for Willow.
That was KSKA's Ellen Lockyer. The state of Alaska will announce soon that it has received a proposal for a would-be liquid natural gas pipeline from the North Slope. As APRN's Peter Granis reports, it's likely to offer more details, but it will be far from definitive.
The announcement will come from the state, not from BP Alaska, ExxonMobil, or ConocoPhillips. Those 3 companies comprise the Alaska Pipeline Partnership and would all help in construction of an LNG pipeline. None of the companies would offer any details of what the plan looks like, or just what Governor Sean Parnell or Commissioner Dan Sullivan might announce. Larry Persily heads the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. That's a federal office in Washington, D.C. He says the companies are years away from committing to the pipeline that will cost tens of billions of dollars to build.
No matter that Alaskans want to hear it, they're years away from being able to make an informed, intelligent business decision to place an order for steel and compressors and modules and all the rest to start construction.
Simply put, Persily says the engineers need to decide what they are going to build and where they plan on building it.
It'd be nice if they fill in some information on some of the things they're going to be working on in the next year so that Alaskans can get a better picture of the plans, of a timeline. But there is no way they're at a point to announce anything close to construction.
Earlier this year, Governor Parnell asked the three companies to submit proposals for the plan. He's been in Asia, trying to drum up clients for LNG exports. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an opera premiere in Anchorage highlights the first woman to run for president in 1872.
She says, even though I will never get there, they will pick up my ideas and they will carry them forward.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Anchorage police have released the identity of the woman whose body was found in a church parking lot. Police spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says in a release that the homicide victim was Maria Abramczyk. The 44-year-old woman was from Anchorage. Her body was found yesterday morning in the parking lot of the Anchorage Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Church on Turnigan Avenue in West Anchorage. Police are calling her death a homicide, but haven't released details of how she died. A Bethel man died last night after police officers shot him. The Bethel Police Department has not released the name of the person, saying they still need to confirm his identity and contact his next of kin. The incident happened just before 11 p.m. when police officers were called to a disturbance at a home in Bethel. Police are not releasing the address of the home at this time. While they were there, a police officer fatally shot a man. Afterwards, police officers called the Alaska State Troopers in Bethel, who sent three troopers to help secure the scene. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation in Anchorage flew in personnel this morning who were in the process of investigating. The man's body is being transported to the State Medical Examiner's Office in Anchorage for an autopsy. In a written statement, Bethel police say they plan to release the name of the officer who was involved in the shooting in a later release. The cleanup process in Talkeetna, where September's heavy rain floodwaters threatened 100 or so homes, is a slow process. For the people who have seen the worst damage, the recovery is even slower. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton reports.
Cheryl Tollefson's house on I Street in East Talkeetna was among the worst of all her neighbors' houses. They have a basement that 10 days after the floodwater subsided was still seeping groundwater.
At this time, because the water table is still high, though we have a sump pump going, you just have to be patient for the water table to drop so that we can finish pumping. We went to our lot behind us, and the cabin was just you can hardly get to it, you know, and it's just all sewer in through there. So, you know, we'll sprinkle lime when we're done.
Much of the basement was used for living space and appliances, including their heater. But due to the continued presence of water in their home, they aren't able to get a good idea of exactly how much damage has been done. Tollefson expects she'll have to throw away nearly everything that has come into contact with the floodwaters.
Couches, chairs, freezers. We have two freezers. We have no heat because our boiler was underwater, as well as our wood stove. The stench in our home is just unbearable. We still, when we left today, have 8 inches of sewer water in our basement. We've been adding bleach, but it's still sewer.
Emergency assistance so far has been useful. The Red Cross has taken on client casework this week, and disaster recovery assistance will open in flood-affected areas next week to help people file for individual assistance grants. But a borough requirement that requires residents obtain a flood hazard building permit before doing repairs to their structures is slowing things down. As for mitigating future flood damage, FEMA's guidelines for rebuilding in flood zones includes advice such as raising the residents above the base flood elevation, something that is not practical for many residents in East Talkeetna. I'm Lorian Nettleton.
The Alaska Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a Washington-based company in a long-running legal dispute over Brooks Range area gold mining claims. The High Court ruling gives 20 contested claims in the Chandelier region to Gold Rich Mining. Company CEO Bill Shara says it reaffirms a state Superior Court jury decision that found the other company, Gold Dust Incorporated, must relinquish the claims. Shara says the issue began when Gold Rich was leasing property to Gold Dust.
They went into bankruptcy. They couldn't pay us. Gold Rich was forced to drop a few claims. And during that time, then Gold Dust went and reclaimed the claims that Gold Rich had to drop.
Shara says getting the ruling ends a five-year legal dispute and takes a cloud off the 20 contested claims, clarifying title and enabling investment. He says his company, which now has 197 total claims in the Chandelier area, is moving ahead on exploration and placer gold development.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. A fall can cause traumatic brain injury and require follow-up care outside of your home community. To help prevent falls, eat foods that are rich in calcium and vitamin D, like fish head soup and kelp with herring eggs. Be active, walk often, participate in subsistence activities, and have your vision checked at least once a year. More information at anthc.org. This message sponsored by the ANTHC Injury Prevention Program.
It's been 4 years since the road that created a loop around Bethel has been closed. It has forced traffic to maneuver through town on a horseshoe-shaped road system. As KYUK's Angela Denning-Barnes reports, the city's 6,000 residents will have to wait at least another year before it can reopen.
Tundra Ridge Road, also known as the Polk Road, closed to the public in 2008 when the Polk family blocked off their native allotment, making the road impassable. State Department of Transportation representatives spoke to the Bethel City Council with an update on efforts to get the road reopened. Morgan Merritt with DOT says there's been another delay.
We are now saying it's more likely to be in 2014.
That was news to Bethel City Council members, including Kent Harding.
Last we heard, it would be in February of 2013.
But the reasons given for the delay aren't new. Merritt says the project has taken longer than expected, mainly because of the lengthy process working with the BIA, who represents the property owners. Meanwhile, the city has been told to stay out of negotiations in a letter from the BIA and by the state. Mayor Joseph Klyka.
We were told this spring to stay out of it because it would be solved by this fall. That was the word from the state.
Johann Mueller is the state's right-of-way agent. He's been negotiating with the BIA. He told council that acquiring the right-of-way to this road is still going to be faster than pursuing an alternative road.
You're going to face the same issues. You still have allotments to go through. You're still going to have the EA to go through. You're still going to have the design to go through. So you're just going to be starting the ball over again.
EAs are environmental assessments, one of the many processes required for any road in the area. The Polk family was unsatisfied with the road long before they closed it in 2008. It was never maintained properly and created deep muck holes every wet season. Earl Polk Jr., one of the four Polk brothers, says he helped pull out at least 100 vehicles near his home.
And I got sick and tired of pushing them out to the point where I said, look at this, I'm completely covered in mud, I'm brushing my teeth with sand, and it's just crazy. That's got to stop.
There has never been proper drainage along the road. One of the reasons is because no one officially owns it. The road has existed for decades to access H. Marker Lake used by float planes, but there's no real record of it on paper. Proper right-of-ways were not acquired once Native allotments were set aside through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971. The state acknowledges that before reopening it, the road would need to be redesigned because of bad culverts and other needed upgrades. The strip of Polk property in question is about a quarter mile long and 30 feet wide. The Polk family is willing to sell it to the state if the price is fair, and that's been a sticking point in the past. When talks first began, the family says they were offered 3.5 cents a square foot, which was offensive.
At first, because there was anger involved, we were going to go shoot for the high mark, which was, you know, over 100,000. And then it went down and says, okay, now let's negotiate a little bit between the brothers so that what came up was a fair amount.
The exact amount is under wraps as the deal isn't complete. Polk says the whole family wants the road open. He says they never wanted it to take years.
It's caused a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of bad feelings between us and people we grew up with. And it's just, for me, I know, and for my brothers, I know that we would just like it to get done and over with and move on.
Meanwhile, Bethel City Council says it's a safety and economic issue and needs a resolution soon. Mayor Klaka directed the city to write a letter to the congressional delegation and state administration about the issue. In the meantime, Bethel residents will continue to drive the horseshoe around town until a final resolution is reached. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska audiences don't usually get to see the world premiere of a major art performance, but this weekend that will change when the Anchorage Opera stages Mrs. President. The opera tells the remarkable but true story of Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president of the United States in 1872. APRN's Annie Feit dropped in on a rehearsal and has this story.
There is no actual stage for this rehearsal. Instead, the outline of one is marked with gaffing tape on the carpeted floor of an office space in downtown Anchorage. The room is empty except for a few folding tables and chairs and a piano. But if you close your eyes, it sounds a lot like a theater.
One more conquest in her vile, vile crusade. It is she who led me astray, who led me astray, who led me astray.
Then, remembering his feelings about this idea,
she,
free love.
Is it her that...
Scott Ramsey is reviewing a scene with director Lemuel Wade. Ramsey plays one of the lead roles, Henry Ward Beecher, the preacher who is at first a friend, then an enemy to presidential candidate Victoria Woodhull. And he needs to get inside the head of his character quickly.
This is one of the shortest rehearsal processes I've been involved in.
The cast has just over a week to bring the world premiere of Mrs. President together. Ramsey says a month would be more typical. This is opera on a budget. The production will be spare, without elaborate sets. But Ramsey says it's exciting to be part of the early development of the opera.
With a piece like this, it's not incredibly profitable monetarily wise, but it's something as an artist, when you get to invest in doing a brand new piece, it's like you're part of the creation process.
That creation process began with composer Victoria Bond. She had never heard of Victoria Woodhull until her mother discovered a plaque describing her as the first woman to run for president. When Bond started researching Woodhull's story, she quickly realized it had the potential to be a great opera.
It had such dramatic moments to it. And, you know, I mean, it's got love and death and sex and politics. And, you know, it's got all of the right elements.
Woodhull ran for president in 1872 with Frederick Douglass as a running mate. Amazingly, neither one of them could vote. Woodhull was a newspaper publisher who championed women's rights and the idea of free love. Bond says that meant being able to divorce without losing your children, property, or standing in society.
So her definition of free love was that you are free to dissolve a relationship when love is no longer part of it, which seems completely reasonable to us today, but was not reasonable to society at that time.
Bond thinks Woodhull's story has particular resonance during this election season, when many women's rights issues are still being debated. Soprano Valerie Bernhardt agrees the piece is timely. She plays Woodhull, and she says she was immediately drawn to the character.
When I went in for the audition, you know, I told Victoria, I said, I'm just completely captivated by this whole project, and even if I don't get the role, I want to take the aria and use it in my own career, and I want to, just know more about it and am happier for having known about it.
Bernhardt was also drawn to the idea of premiering the opera in Anchorage. She had never been to Alaska, so she says the prospect of performing in the state seemed exotic and exciting. Scott Ramsey, who plays Henry Ward Beecher, was initially more skeptical about the remote location, but now he has embraced the setting.
As we came up today, Valerie and I were in the elevator, and I said, let's go up to the 8th floor and take a look at the mountains. And, you know, we just sat up there and just watched the mountains. It's just breathtaking. And, I mean, what better place to make art and be inspired?
It's not over.
Back on the 2nd floor, Valerie Bernhardt is rehearsing the final scene. I don't want to give away the ending, but it won't shock you to learn Victoria Woodhull does not win the presidency. She hits rock bottom, but she imagines the female pioneers who will follow her.
They may crush me. They may kill me. From my ashes, 1,000 more will rise.
And to me, this is the moment where she really shows her greatest strength, because she says, even though I will never get there, other people, other women will come after me, and they will, it makes me cry, it's so powerful. They will pick up my ideas and they will carry them forward. And what we're hoping in the last scene of this opera is that we will get some prominent members from the Anchorage community to come up on stage and to visibly demonstrate how these ideas of women's independence and leadership have been carried forward to 2012.
Mrs. President will be performed twice this weekend in Anchorage, but after that, its fate is uncertain. No other opera companies have scheduled it for production. But Victoria Bond and Valerie Bernhardt think that Mrs. President could have broad appeal, and they hope it will be performed to much wider audiences after its humble debut in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Mrs. President will be performed at the Discovery Theater Friday, October 5th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, October 7th at 4 p.m. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Miller in Juneau, Ariel Van Cleve in Wrangell, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Annie Feit from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.